Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Maya Lubeck, and I'm one of the class of 2017 new Labour Members of Parliament. This is my very first time to have a slot on Red Alert, and I'm slightly nervous about it, so bear with me. I hope all goes well. Just to give you some background to myself, I was born in Holland. I arrived in New Zealand in 1989, nearly 30 years ago, just to come and have a look at the other side of the world. But very quickly, I fell in love with New Zealand, the way of life, and I fell in love with a Kiwi. So nearly 30 years later, still with that same Kiwi, and we have a son who's 16. We live up north, close to Wellsford, on a five-acre block with some cows, three chickens and a duck. A bit about my work history. It starts really in Air New Zealand at 1996, when I joined a union of flight attendants, became a delegate, and eventually I ended up being elected as FAS as president in 2009, and I served four terms. In 2009, I also started studying law. And not really to become a lawyer, but it was the time of the global financial crisis, and we had a lot of issues with people being made redundant and restructures. And during that time, I saw the personal devastation of people on losing their jobs. So I became determined that I wanted to learn and know about the law and use that knowledge in my union role. So I studied part-time while I was working and graduated in 2014 with a law degree. So how did I end up as a candidate for Labour running a campaign in Rodney? Well, like many others, I was very unhappy with what I saw was a growing inequality, a growing unfairness in New Zealand. And when I first came here 30 years ago, there wasn't any people sleeping under bridges or in cars. So I saw continued slashing of funding in healthcare and education, and meeting plenty of people who no matter how many hours they put in, just couldn't make ends meet. So I became determined that I wanted to do something about it. I joined Labour during the centenary in 2016, was elected as the Labour candidate for Rodney, and as they say, the rest is history. In my maiden speech in Parliament, I talked a bit about working people and how I stand united with working people and their families. And I'd also talked about the importance of unions as being made up of people who really care and want to make a difference to the lives of working people and their families. So in my job in Air New Zealand, I was the lead advocate in negotiations with the airlines. I was also a member of what they call the Air New Zealand High Performance Engagement Leadership Team. It basically meant that we were working since 2013 in a consensus-based workplace democracy program. Sounds rather complicated, but what it is really, it's a change from the adversarial employer-union relationship. It's not a traditional kind of working together, and that is really the sort of relationship I want to talk about today. And I'm very lucky to have as my guests in the studio today Kelvin Ellis, who is a previous organiser for the EPMU, and I've known him as the Director of Organising or the Head of Aviation at the Air 2 Union. During our time at Air 2, we worked together at with High Performance Engagement in Air New Zealand. Kelvin is now the manager at North Power for People and Capability, and I'm looking forward to talking to him about all the new experiences. Then we have Helen Delaney. Helen completed her PhD at the University of Auckland before undertaking a three-year postdoctoral research fellowship at the Department of Business Administration at Lund University in Sweden. She is now a senior lecturer in the Department of Management and International Business at the University of Auckland. And then we have Richard Wagstaff. Richard is joining us on the phone, and Richard is the New Zealand Council of Trade Unions president. He's held that position since 2015, and until that time, since 2000, he was the National Secretary of the PSA. So 30 years of experience in a union environment, no doubt he'll have a lot to tell us. He's also very passionate about high-performance, high-engagement work models. So if I may start with Richard. Just making sure you're there, Richard.
Yes,
that's very good. Hi, Richard. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
just wanted to ask if you could comment us for us on messages that we see coming at the moment from the opposition, that unions aren't good for the economy and that workers don't need unions, and unions are really an old mechanism that we don't need in these modern times. I'd like to have your comments on that, as well as maybe some messages, important messages that you have seen coming from the new Minister for Workplace Relations.
Yeah, those sort of old political messages trying to push back unions and the rights of working people, supposedly in the interest of business, you know, they're pretty tired, but we keep hearing them again and again. But they just don't stand up to scrutiny, it seems to me. If you look at the successful economies that we would aspire to, ones that have a higher productivity, higher wage rates, lower sort of social problems statistics, like the Scandinavians and the Europeans, they have far higher rates of unionisation, far more many people are in unions. And so it just doesn't stand up, the idea that somehow the economy is impaired if you have a strong union movement. In fact, I would argue quite the opposite. But really, you know, so if higher wages, if job security, if health and safety standards are good for the economy, then unions are certainly good for the economy too, because those are all things and others that we stand for. But more than that, I think, you know, what we should be thinking about is not what is just good for the economy, because while a thriving economy is important, in itself it doesn't mean that everyone's happy. It could mean that all the fruits of the economy are going to a few people, while most people aren't doing very well. And it's important that we share. And I think unions, what they do in an economic sense, is help share the benefits of the economy and share the opportunities. And it's something we haven't been seeing of late. In fact, the labour share of the economy has been in decline. And that goes hand in hand with the drop of collective bargaining, and international organisations like the IMF and the World Bank themselves have actually pointed out that since the global financial crisis, you know, the drop in unions has been a problem. But what I wanted to say actually is that it's not just the economy that matters. Surely what we should be more concerned about is society and democracy. And in my view, unions are absolutely vital. It's critical that people have a voice in democracies. And without unions, it's difficult to see how working people, a big chunk of the population, has an effective voice. And in fact, I would argue further that we need democracy in our workplaces, and unions need to be able to bring support and voice to workers, so that not just in the wider society, but actually in our workplaces, we have a culture of democracy, one where people can speak up, be listened to, be heard, and have support. All of those things add up to a much higher functioning society, a much higher functioning economy, and a much better place to live in. So, you know, I think these old-fashioned ideas of unions about the economy are really just sort of political kind of dog whistles. They're not really based on any fact or evidence.
That's a very full message you're giving us there. Thank you for that, Richard. Just to the end bit of my question with regards to important messages that you've seen coming from the new Minister for Workplace Relations, is there anything you'd like to comment on that?
Yeah, well, what we're seeing with the new Minister, Ian Laird-Galloway, is certainly an acceptance that unions play a really important role and should be supported so that they can do their role. And so we're seeing with the law changes that they've proposed in the new bill, says that unions should be able to basically organise and collectively bargaining. They should be able to, employers should have to meet them in good faith, they should have access to workers and all those kinds of things. Sends a very different signal to the one we've had for the last almost a decade with the previous government, where, you know, unions were really on the back foot in terms of the political and legislative environment. So it's really good to see that. We know the minister and I think his government recognise the value of unions. They want to promote a tripartite process for changes, which is to involve business, unions and government in change. It's just a much more open and constructive approach to working people and unions, I think we're finding with Ian Lees Galloway's and compared to his predecessor in the previous government.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Richard. And I think it is a nice segue into a question that I want to put to Helen. Because, Richard, you mentioned a different situation in European countries. So I can ask Helen about your research into collaborative workplace models and work-life balance. So we see an increasing demand by employers for flexibility in work hours. Can I get some comments from you on what you've seen working well or better or different in that aspect?
Absolutely. So a little background to my research, I guess. So from 2013, I've been really curious about the several cases within the New Zealand context where sophisticated trade union leaders and their officials are partnering together with management, both in private sector and public sector companies, and just exploring that process and some of the outcomes of it. More recently, I'm leading the qualitative research for what's been known as the four-day working week project that's happening at Perpetual Guardian, and directly, so there's no union involvement there, but they are reconsidering, I guess, some of the ideas around employee involvement and how do we want to work and why do we work and how does work fit into a good life and into a good society. So in regards to this question of flexibility, yes, I can see that there are demands coming from employers and perhaps from some elements of the state, but I also hear it actually a lot in my lecture theatres. So I think amongst younger workers, but also workers of my generation, there is a hope and an expectation of constructing a good, flourishing, enriching life where work is one element of that. So yes, the demand for flexibility comes from external forces, but I think there's also a demand amongst workers themselves, and rightfully so. And so one of the things I'm interested in is how I think it's, I guess, evidence from my research is suggesting that it's really important to have a trade union voice in some of those conversations about what does flexibility mean and for whose interest and purpose does it serve. And the role of, you know, trade union actors is really important because they can regulate some of the power, let's say, of other actors who may want to see flexibility just in terms of job cuts and job loss. And trade unions are able to bring to the table really sophisticated understandings of management and organising and to broaden out some of that discussion so that it meets both management's interests and also workers' interests too. To have a flourishing life where work is a crucial part of it and their protections are not being eroded through this idea of flexibility.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Helen. That's a good insight. I guess thinking a bit further about it, so you're talking about your experience with you know, workplaces with and without unions and the voice for workers that I'm interested in now, because Richard touched on that as well. So going across the table and asking Kelvin a little bit about his practical experience with high-performance engagement work models. So how do you see that give workers maybe a better voice, but also what do you see as the challenges in a high-performance engaged model? And you might want to run us a little bit about through what it actually looks like, a model like that.
Yeah, sure. So if I'm thinking about the Air New Zealand model, which is obviously been talked about a lot and in detail, it really is a genuine strategic partnership, and it's about how do unions and their members come to the table in a really strategic way to think about what's in the best interests of not only themselves but their employers, or in the company's case, you know, they're thinking about their employees too, and making sure all of those interests are represented. It's really complex and it's really difficult, I think, to kind of get into that space, particularly when you look at the more traditional models that both management in New Zealand and unions have come from, where the managers did all the strategy and the unions challenged that, right? That's the kind of, I guess, the place we've come from. So how do you then move into that different space? And it needs a certain change in skills for both managers and unions, and I think that's been the hardest part, and that's been the bit that Air New Zealand, I think, is still struggling with, is how do you get managers to open up and let people into their strategies, and then how do you get unions with the capability being developed to have those kind of conversations? I think that's kind of the toughest part of of doing this, but it's the most rewarding part too, because you're linking people into their work. And if you look at kind of the millennials coming through, all the research is saying they want to make their mark on the world, they want to have real influence, and they want to have it now. And these kind of work models give them that and enable that and empower that. But, it is really tough for managers and unions, I think, to get their heads around that. I think that's the biggest challenge.
Yes, so you talk about, and I think that's a good comment, linking people into work is a nice way of describing engagement with what you're doing. And that's good, but how do you measure that success?
Wow.
That's a hard one, though, I think.
That's really difficult. I think, you know, one of the greatest things I've seen in these kind of things is this idea of discretionary effort. And that's not people staying late without being paid or anything like that. That's people stepping up and owning their work. But it's also, you know, employers rewarding and recognising that. And that's kind of the key thing. But it's really hard to measure, right? You don't know. But, you know, every time I see an article on the news about someone going the extra distance at Kiwi Rail or, you know, at Air New Zealand, chucking a goldfish on a plane when they didn't have to and those sorts of things, that's your discretionary effort, that's the company's brand, but it's also the workers getting involved and pitching in. And it's almost impossible to measure, but it's a really, really important part of this. It's people owning that space. To be honest, I don't know how you measure success. I certainly know from the union perspective, membership growth has been really significant in these kind of partnerships, and that's quite important when you're looking at private sector union density declining. And yet you see these high performance, high engagement kind of work models. You see union membership going up because people want to be involved, they want to be part of a positive story. So I think that's a good measure for unions to look at. But from an employer perspective, there's a whole bunch of different things that go on, and I think it would be quite difficult to measure.
So if I can jump in here, so a lot of international research has tried to address this thorny question of what does success mean in partnership, and they tend to divide the results into two, you know, loose categories: hard economic outcomes and sort of soft social relations outcomes. So in terms of some of those hard outcomes of, you know, what results from collaborative workplace partnership, it's things like an increase in productivity, you know, from the organisation's perspective, an increase in productivity, cost savings, reduced health and safety accidents, and reduced absenteeism and turnover. So things that can, you know, quite crucial things to the success of the organisation. There are, as Calvin was saying, this union membership question for unions, and also for workers, and what I've seen evidence of here is that workers do experience some kind of financial improvements in their life as well. That could be wage rates, but it could also be broader kind of terms and conditions that matter to them. But one of the things I think that's really important to better understand are some of their social outcomes, and I can just list some that I'm starting to see, if that's helpful. So first and foremost, undoubtedly, I've seen evidence of unions and workers having greater influence in managerial decision-making. So through forms of collaboration, one of the things it demands is that the organisation shares more of their knowledge and decision-making and they open that up for unions and workers to construct some of those problems and some of the solutions to it. So it's far more than just consultation. It's collaboratively working together to figure out problems and the solutions for them. And they have to be open to some of those results. But it does mean that therefore there are instances where unions have been able to halt job loss or outsourcing, you know, where workers have been able to change the way they work in ways that matter to them. But broader than that, you know, I see a lot of what we'd call sort of the social relations of production improving. And it's, you know, imagine you're turning up to work and it's things like you now have a greater sense that you belong in this place, that you have a voice and it is heard and it is making a difference. And there's kind of a sense of individual and collective mana that comes from that experience. I see an increase in empathy, particularly between different groups in the organisation that often wouldn't cross paths or that historically were quite combative towards each other. So people turning up who now understand, because they've had to sit in a room for days on end and kind of understand competing interests, they now understand why people think certain ways and how their lives are different, and they respect the difference between them, I guess. I also see what Calvin calls, you know, discretionary effort. I see that, but I also see something more broader, which is a greater readiness to act in the interests of the organisation. So there are workers who previously have thought, this place doesn't care about me, I have no voice, it's just going to keep doing things to me like it's always done, and I'm going to eventually kind of lose out. And through being able to have an active role in constructing the organisation, they start to feel the sense of goodwill, and it's shared from managers to workers as well. So there's this kind of reciprocity that goes between managers and workers, and this greater treatment, I think, of dignity between the two, that both have a legitimate place in the business. So all of this, you know, one of the things that we're trying to argue based on this evidence is all of these, you know, how we relate to each other at work, these are crucial skills for participating in society more broadly. And it goes back to what Richard said at the beginning, I guess, which is our argument based on our evidence is that through collaborative work models, we are starting to see the development of what we'd call social democratic sensibilities. That's the way in which you empathise with other people, particularly other people who, you know, are from very different backgrounds to yours. You understand them, you empathise them, you feel with them and try to improve each other's lives. You engage in really deliberative conversation. So one thing that comes through collaborative work models, I think, is a greater ability to question each other and challenge each other, particularly in hierarchies. You know, there's evidence of workers starting to challenge managers and managers welcoming that challenge because it advances their work together. So they seek countering opinions and together try to come up with more innovative solutions that try to meet the interests of all different groups of people. Sometimes that doesn't happen. Of course, these things are contested and they're hard. But they're trying to improve things. They're trying to progress the way that they're working. And all of these skills are what we need essentially to improve society and to tackle some of these large issues that we're trying to confront together.
Could I just come in here?
Yeah, I was actually just going to put it through to you because I thought you might want to comment on that, Richard. Thank you.
That was great, Helen. That was, I would agree with all of those things. I think what we need to remember too, that unfortunately a lot of workplaces actually have a culture that is based on a master-servant relationship. Some of these old-fashioned management models are quite prevalent in New Zealand, where people turn up for work and they leave their brains out the door, and they leave, if you like, their basic civil rights outside the door and their democratic rights. And they go to work, they keep themselves safe, they do what they're told, they're not expected to do anything else or to speak up. And so, you know, people in those sorts of cultures tend to keep themselves safe. If you think of any kind of authoritarian culture, whether it be at work, in the family, or even in a nation, what people do is they close down, all they do is what they're told, they don't take the initiative and they keep themselves safe. And I think there's a bit of that in many workplaces in New Zealand. They don't, whereas if you have a more open and democratic kind of culture, where people speak up, be supported, they're listened to, they actively engage in real conversation about their lives and what's going on, it's a far more functional human culture to work in, and it's much more productive. And it's much more natural for people to function in, as opposed to an authoritarian culture, which I would say is quite an alienating place to be. And, you know, this is very real. And we meet people who experience a high engagement, high performance culture, and they say, work is a completely different thing to me now. It's something that I own, I love coming to, I love my union, I'm respected here. Work is giving me a sense of dignity and self-worth instead of going to work where I'm talked down to and treated like dirt all day. So it really changes people's whole perception of themselves and their place in the social order. I just want to make a final point is that, you know, you won't meet many businesses who don't say they're all for high engagement, they're all for high performance. But in my experience, very, very few of them can do it because they tend to have a traditional master-servant culture at their work. And they'll put on the website, if you've got an idea, email me, and they think that that's an open kind of culture, when in fact, in reality, it's nothing like it. And, you know, there's a lot of fake, in my view, sort of false promises of openness and engagement, and a few engagement surveys. But in reality, from our point of view, that unless people feel empowered and truly safe and supported to speak up and challenge authority, they won't do it. And I think that's one of the real benefits that unions bring in to these places, because we work to support people, to encourage them to speak up and to protect them in that process, and to also to really bring a meaningful challenge to employers about the way they behave and the need for them to be less authoritarian and more facilitative. You know, people can't do that on their own, but with the support of a union and with a union working with sort of the management team as a whole to co-sponsor a change in workplace culture, you know, that can become a reality. I would suggest that without a union, this kind of culture is very difficult to build and sustain over the long term.
Sure. And so I guess, you know, you're really giving us a message that you believe that, you know, employers working with unions, encouraging, you know, productive, high engagement, high trust workplaces is ultimately going to give us good results, which will improve the way that we actually do work in New Zealand.
I'd like to see employers see unions as an opportunity instead of just a threat. And some progressive employers do, and certainly I think we're seeing that in the places like Air New Zealand. But too many of them are defensive and see unions as a threat to their kind of controlling methodology, which is, we are a threat to authoritarianism. We are a threat to workers being treated badly. Absolutely, we stand by that. But we actually support businesses being successful too, because we know ultimately our members want to work in successful businesses, that their wages depend on successful businesses, and so do jobs. So, you know, we really got to get beyond those old-fashioned dichotomies of economy good, worker unions bad, or something like that. In fact, we see ourselves as part of the same journey, and we have enormous shared interests, but also for us, a successful economy must include successes for working people. It can't be just on its own.
Yeah. Look, and you mentioned going on a journey, which makes me think about Air New Zealand. I want to pitch it back to Kelvin and ask him a little bit about his experience in Air New Zealand as a business that operates in a culture of respectful dialogue. Just give us a little bit of an insight into what you think went well, and to get that relationship changing, but also what do you see could be some of the hurdles that other businesses can face.
Yeah, I think, and this is that overall mindset change. I think unions need to change their mindset as much as employers in this space, right? In the Air New Zealand model, the success of it was reliant on senior union leadership and senior corporate leadership driving it through. But there was a whole lot of stuff that went on underneath that wasn't so good. So there was a bit of traditional unionism going on, and there was a lot of traditional management going on. So the real successes came when people were able to get beyond that, change their mindsets, and actually genuinely work together in a really open way. And I think of some really good examples where positions were parked at the door and people said, well, what's good for everyone and what can we do? And they really worked together to do it. But I think that doesn't happen all the time. Even within the Air New Zealand model, it wasn't happening all the time. And I think that's the critical piece in all this, is changing that mindset to say, actually, we're going to try and work together. And unions have a lot of work to do on that. Employers have a lot of work to do on that. And that's the challenge. And that's where I think actually government can help out, or to support that development, support that training, and say, hey, we're gonna work in this way. And this is let's tell those stories, but let's give people the support and training to work in that way. I think that's the critical piece.
Really a tripartite approach,
that's
rather
right.
than, you know, unions and or employers and workforce and unions trying to sort of find out for themselves.
Yeah.
We're sort of wrapping up. I see that we're coming up to the last 3 minutes. I'm getting the signal from the lady behind the glass. All new to me here. So basically what I want to do to wrap it up is I want to put a question out there, and whoever wants to comment on it. But basically, Richard, I want to congratulate you also on successes that you've had, like pay equity and the removal of zero-hour contracts, despite what has been an adversarial political environment of the last decade. What is the potential in this changed government, changed environment that we're seeing coming up? What is the potential that we could? How long is a piece of string, really? But what's the hope for the future?
well, I'm glad you said the future, because this whole thinking about the future of work that certainly Grant Robertson has been turning his mind to, and we've been talking to him about new ways of working, is an enormous opportunity. But it's also an enormous threat. I mean, we've got enormous change coming at us. We need to get better at what we do. Our productivity is poor. Our businesses has got massive change in terms of IT and all these things coming, climate change and demographics coming at us. So we can't sit still. I hope that we learn from the things we're hearing about today and in other areas, and we really seize the initiative and make New Zealand the best place to work and the best place to do business. And that's the opportunity, but it won't happen by accident. It's going to take some serious leadership and some real courage, and the union movement is absolutely up for that.
Yeah. And if I can just say, I work in an industry that's facing radical change going forward, and if we all take our corners, we're not going to face it. We've got to get together. And
that's fantastic. Look, I see that we have 20 seconds on the clock, so may I thank my guests so much for all your wonderful input. I've really enjoyed this. Mm. And Helen, Kelvin, Richard on the phone, thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to my next slot.
Thanks, Maya.
Get together next week at 9:05 a.m. or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/RedAlertRadio.